Welcome to episode 6 of Decoded, a podcast by Marriott Digital Services, bringing together the smartest minds, the best leaders in the digital space, all part of a 10-part series on all things digital marketing. I'm Chris, Director of Customer Success for Marriott Digital Services, and I'm joined by Mike, Director of Program Management for our team too. So hi, Mike, how are you?
Well, Chris, how are you?
I am fantastic. So this week, we're going to talk just the news. We're not going to have like a particular focus educational session. There is a crazy amount of things going on in the world of digital. So we're going to do our best to kind of round up the top stories from the last few weeks. So I know that there's been some talks recently with regards to Google. And I think I mentioned this last time this podcast was on, like we can't go a week without mentioning Google. So, and they've been talking quality backlinks, Mike, and some updates there.
For sure. You're absolutely right, Chris. It's one of those topics you can never really escape from even for a week. So many of you may know that one of the factors that goes into search ranking is quality backlinks that basically direct from one website to another. It's constantly brought up for years of what is a good backlink, what is not a good backlink, and then what looks like it may have been paid or obtained naturally. And this has been one of those topics where it's always hard to get a really good answer from people. Google has had various spokespeople over the years that have dodged it, answered it. We have a story this week from Search Engine Journal where they pulled out office hours from this guy named John Mueller, I think is how you say it. I think he's a European gentleman, so maybe you know him, Chris, from back in the day. But the basic question was like, how can you determine what is a good backlink and how does it look natural? And the SEO community, which is one that always tries to get the truth of it, kind of tore it apart a little bit and gave him some scrutiny for the fact that he paused before he said a quote. And the reality of it is that he just wants to make sure that if you are a website that you are obtaining links that look like they are naturally related to each other, right? So if I'm operating a screen printing company, inbound links or outbound links for me to like a pet boarding site, they don't make any sense. It's just a matter of like, maybe it's a high quality link, but there's no category relationship or anything there. So it's one of those things where Google's always trying to make sure that there's good connection between items and that there is not anything that looks like it's funny business. Because if they can smell funny business, then they're not really interested in it.
I guess we had that conversation, was it 2 or 3 episodes ago when we talked about the customer experience? And I guess it all comes back to that, right? They're just trying to do their utmost, whether it impacts SEO or not, to make sure that the customer experience makes sense.
I think it's one of those areas where they're always looking about what is the next thing that's either going to be important to them or what is a fundamental they never want to shake, right? Because I think we've noticed as a company, Google doesn't really have a very good clock for what they've done and not done. They constantly change products. They throw them out every year. We have another good example of that from Google News too, is for years, we've seen a lot of those product ads that are at the top of search results. And those are largely links over to brands, manufacturers, resellers, where they're basically called Google shopping feeds. And when I got my career start in digital marketing, that was the heyday of things like Shopzilla, BuyRate. Like it was just all these feed engines that were, what is a new product? You click through and then you can find the listing. And then a little company called Amazon came along and basically ate all of that. So the news out this week is that Google is shutting down their tool for basically managing those listings. And they're taking it out of the search experience in the coming weeks. I think it's April 1st is the pull down date. So I think my question to you, Chris, as we keep noodling on Google changes and everything, is that something you ever used? And is it something that you'll miss?
Never used it. I would say that 99% of my shopping today is done on Amazon of some variety, whether it's ordering stuff from Whole Foods or whether it's ordering a new thermometer for my barbecue. Like it's it all comes just because it's so easy.
It's true. I mean, I personally have account fatigue at this point of like, if I can buy even for $2 more on Amazon or Walmart versus another site, I will always go to what I know at this point.
Yep. So talking of some more changes, which Google company, should we say, are making. So YouTube have announced a couple of new features, one focused on how creators can make money. So in a recent blog post, YouTube's chief product officer, Neil Mohan, outlined how it intended to invest more in the kind of what they deemed as the next generation of video. So one of it was around the imminent rollout of YouTube Shorts in the US, which is like a TikTok, I guess, vertical video format, which we'll go into in a moment. But they also have around 10 different ways that YouTubers can make money, which when I read that, I was like, wow, that seems a lot to me, right? 10 different ways that you can make money from YouTube. But they've announced a couple more. So the first one is something called Applause. And YouTube, basically what they're going to be doing is strengthening the aspect of making money through the wider rollout of this digital product. So ultimately viewers, so you or I, can purchase what they call Applause on videos that they support. So if you're watching something within YouTube, you can purchase Applause, and that money goes directly to the creator. So slightly different to maybe skipping the 5-second advert or something like that. It's similar to something called Super Chats, which I've seen a couple of times, which is something where creators are doing live videos on YouTube, so live streams, whether they're doing Q&A or product reviews or whatever it might be. The key difference, though, is it can be purchased at any time on any video, whereas this like Super Chat concept is more about like I'm hosting a live session and people are donating money to me in the moment, whereas this Applause seems like it's like you're watching a video that was published a year ago and I can still kind of make Applause, I guess. It's currently only available for purchase on desktop and also the YouTube app on Android, but it's also limited in terms of the markets as well. So we've seen this a lot through digital companies, but markets like the US, Australia, Brazil, India, New Zealand, Mexico. So they're sort of, you know, slowly moving into that space, but I think it will roll out more and more. The second one is shopping, actually. So you've seen Facebook make big moves in this space, right, with various different partnerships. So they've actually now, YouTube have announced a full suite of different opportunities through integrated shopping experiences that will roll out later this year on YouTube. And it's currently in beta testing, which will allow users to make purchases on YouTube without even leaving the site. So you think about selling, you know, if you've got a product video, feature video, whatever it might be, you might be able to buy that product directly within YouTube, which is, I think, a really cool enhancement.
I would agree. So to touch on the first one about the new Shorts concept and Applause and so forth, what I love about the idea is basically it's acknowledging that there's sites like Patreon out there where I think everybody's aware that there's this really big push to like directly fund the creator, right? No matter what that is, if it's an artist, if it's videographer, whatever it could be. I mean, there's a YouTube channel that I subscribe to. It's called CPG Gray, and he does these very cool video shorts of very heady subjects of like, this is how the economy works. This is how the US Electoral College works. And what I've learned from listening to one of his podcasts is basically he has a Patreon page where basically he collects money around a video, gives it to people earlier, and then based on their feedback, he may or may not tweak it. And then that video then goes live to the rest of the world, but he'll turn off ads for certain people. So it's very cool to see like YouTube acknowledging that like they're probably, if you're the creator, you're underpaid by how much value you're producing for Google. But it is really cool to see them publicly acknowledge that and do something about it.
Yeah, so YouTube Shorts, this is, it's TikTok for YouTube, ultimately. It's as we mentioned, a vertical video format. It's already been live in India for a while, and now it's coming to the US in March, so very, very soon. It ultimately allows users to create like a 15-second clip. And, you know, YouTube is revealing that they've got a lot of engagement through this different channel. And in India, they were getting 3.5 billion daily views. I mean, that's crazy, right? I mean, the amount of views they're getting, it's big. So the format really comprises of, you know, is think TikTok, but it allows users to create and upload the videos, as we mentioned, about 15 seconds, edit the videos within the platform, stitch together shorter clips. So, you know, you can film multiple different segments with different cameras, add music from the video library, so you can start to see that coming through, speed or slow down videos, and then set timers and countdowns. So that's all good from a creator perspective. You're being given more opportunities to create more content, which can only be a good thing. And then users will be able to navigate from one video to another, like they do today on TikTok or Instagram, that all have very similar products, by just scrolling vertically while viewing the content. Again, that, you know, very, very similar to TikTok. So, you know, they've announced that one of the problems they're trying to solve with this shorts is the high barrier to creating content on YouTube. If you think about, if you said, I want to create a YouTube channel because I need some passive income, you know, you need a camera, you need the editing software, you've got to, there's certain algorithms about lengths of videos. This is kind of trying to remove some of those barriers. So I'm really excited to see this roll out and see the user interaction, but then how brands kind of interact with it as well.
I agree. I think it's really smart to acknowledge that there's other players out there in the ecosystem that are doing work differently, right? I think your point about YouTube somewhat seems like it's a high production place to get into is scary for some people to get into, right? We know the rise of Reels in Instagram is basically just a clone of TikTok. This is another clone of the same thing. And I just find it so fascinating to watch companies steal each other's features and figure out which ones work better. Right. So, you know, Twitter has fleets. I believe we may have talked about this in a previous or our first episode, where it's basically like an Instagram story, which, let's also give credit, was a Snapchat story, of which I don't know if that's still a thing anymore, to see everybody just kind of take those features and, you know, every place becomes a marketplace for every feature. Is it's exciting, but it's sometimes taxing, isn't it? Like, do you even watch, say, stories on Facebook?
No, the only place I will watch stories is on Instagram. I've seen them on LinkedIn. I very rarely engage with them. And I think within LinkedIn, I've noted at the start when LinkedIn first announced their kind of version of it, I noticed there's a lot of engagement, other people posting there. And now I don't see a huge amount of people posting in that space. And I did a few tests and noticed that the level of views that you were getting within that space was low. So people, you know, very quickly assume, okay, well, I'll just spend my effort and energy in other places. So we'll see how it evolves. But yeah, interesting times ahead. And as a fan of bougie barbershops, I was particularly excited to read this. And when I found out it was in Columbus, Ohio, then I realized that I might not be attending anytime soon. But Old Spice have been doing some creative marketing with some physical retail stores. So what's been going on, Mike?
Yeah. So in our favorite town of Columbus, Ohio, where we do have a friend of the show, Brandon Harper, located. So maybe he can go and do a visit for us. Procter & Gamble, who owns Old Spice, has set up a barbershop where basically you can go in there, you can get a haircut, you can use any of Old Spice's products. And I think we know from years, they've had a really cool history of engaging, interactive, kind of fourth wall breaking type of stuff. And this is only continuing it of, you basically can go in there for a haircut with those branded products. You also can more or less have an experience where you can kind of find like Easter eggs that are embedded around, get to know some of the products a little bit deeper. But the cool part about it that I think we both agree with is it's the creation of a content hub, more or less. So over at Marriott, we have a version of that, but this is a cool place where you can come in and have celebrities cut hair, record those things. And then out of the fact that it's, you know, hair grooming, which is such a mundane task now, Old Spice can create a lot of really cool viral clips out of this. They could take up all the video they record there, all the photos they can take there and chop this up to more social media content. They can live stream stuff. They can have guests come through. And I think we all know from looking at Instagram and Facebook and stuff that that's a really popular thing, right? Like that guy from Queer Eye for the Straight Guy has millions of views with his hair tips. And it's like, this is a way that they can control and take their own version of that that experience and try to sell some Old Spice along the way.
Yeah, I mean, what I liked about it was this blend of retail store, which like looks amazing, the idea to generate content and also to get like brand fans through unique experiences when people go in there. Like personally, I spend far too much money on haircuts and because you want the experience, and I can totally see how that resonates with the residents of Columbus, Ohio. So Twitter, They are considering a pay subscription model, which I read and I was like, wow, okay. So it was reported in Bloomberg that Twitter is reporting to look to add a new stream of revenue by offering premium features through what they would call a monthly subscription. So a report in Bloomberg states that the motivation behind adding this subscription-based feature is to ease Twitter's dependence on advertising, which is one of their only sources of revenue today. And they quote, people familiar with the effort. So take of that what you will. They say that Twitter's been actively exploring the subscription model for a while now. Twitter's publicly explored the idea last year through various different surveys, asking users what they'd like to see from a various different subscription service. And ideas considered at the time were to maybe undo send features, custom colors, maybe potentially longer video uploads, special badges, auto responses, and other things. One of the ideas mooted was maybe producing some extensive analytics through a monthly subscription. So maybe today you only get access to views or your likes or followers. Maybe they could surface up some additional analytics to you through your subscription as well. Another thought was today TweetDeck, which is a Twitter product, is currently free, but maybe they put that behind a subscription paywall as well. So people having to pay in order to use it. So there's many different ways that they could sort of make the sausage, if you will, and make the subscription there. So again, long way to go, but I guess a question for you, Mike, is would you pay for a premium subscription in Twitter?
I might, but none of what they said really resonates with me, yeah. Right? So I remember getting Twitter in probably 2007 and not knowing really what it was at all, right? How to use it, what to interact with it. And then slowly you understand the value that something brings to you. And there was a period of time where I'm not sure how everybody is going to remember this, but like all of Twitter was basically views of like third-party apps, right? Of like, you could have your own instance. You could have like, Chris could build what's called a Twitter client. And in that Twitter client, you're able to produce feeds the way you want them, sort them the way you want to. And that was a whole budgeting boutique industry for a while. And then Twitter said, no, we don't want all these kind of sideload experiences of Twitter out there. We want to control the whole thing, right? So they basically shut down the ecosystem. They shut down the APIs. And then they said, okay, you want Twitter, you come here. So when you first dug up this article, I kind of was exasperated of like, they could have done this 5 years ago and it would have been a very different experience. And I think we've talked about this for years that timing is everything with marketing and life and everything, that this doesn't do anything for me at all. If it's more so around, you get access to more of types of news channels that you like that are maybe Twitter exclusives, I think that's something interesting. But I think it's also this mad dash of, you're seeing all these different services try to create alternate revenue streams, and some's going to work and some isn't. Like, in a way, doesn't this sound a little bit like Applause? A little bit?
Although the money in that situation, in Applause, goes to the creator, this money would clearly go to
Twitter.
Jack and Twitter, right? But I think for me, I could see potentially brands doing it if it opens up some additional functionality and features. Right. Potentially, that could be one option. Maybe people with a greater depth of followers that are particularly using this as a revenue generation for themselves that need those kind of additional features that could be suitable for them as well. I think for me, there's two crucial bits of information. One is the price point of which they pitch it at. So if they come out and it's got awfully expensive and it's, you know, to me, the value is not there, then, you know, the number of subscribers is going to be lower. If it's at a price point where it's negligible, then you could see people engaging in that. And then the last is the features that brings you, you know, and are they truly valuable to you as a customer?
Well, I think your point around analytics is key, right? And I think what I struggle with this is, you know, and it's clear it's still all coming together. The sources familiar with the matter quote is your classic interpretation of someone found a little nugget somewhere and they blew it up. The reality of it is Twitter analytics are pretty terrible, right? Unless you take it and plug it into a third party tool to do all that. And we've known from our work too, that everything is turning into some sort of data studio right now, right? Of you need to report on, there's this acknowledgement that you need to report on data in a way that works for your customers or stakeholders or executive suite. And Twitter does a terrible job of that today, right? For the minimal bit of that I see in my normal life compared to when I ran our social team here, it's pretty bad. And you basically have to pull in and extract all that Twitter data into a third-party application to get insights out of it. I think that little nugget of like maybe bonus features you can create or even data, I mean, that's a whole market that they don't have the revenue from because it passes somebody else to do the analytics. So, I mean, I think maybe for a consumer's lens, it's rough, but if you're the person that wants to get more data out of it, and you're an influencer, you're a brand, I can see why you might gobble this up.
So talking about data, and this is a monthly effort that Skift do. They look at all the different sort of local US travel trends and making sure that they're keeping a pulse on what's happening in the various different markets and how people are respecting to travel. So what was in the latest report, Mike? What's been going on?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So the Skift data is always a fun way to look at it and reflect and see like, does this track my own behavior or is this wildly different? So this one is interesting. So according to their latest travel tracker, only 21% of Americans traveled in January 2021. And that's barely 2 percentage points ahead of April 2020, which if you kind of track the US lockdowns, that was basically when the world shut down. So what this quote is basically saying is it's unchanged for not a year, but basically 10 months. And then it goes on to say with all of the precautions around the vaccination rollout and cards, and then all the fact that, I mean, there's so many different laws that are coming up right now around like, if you want to travel from state to state, do you need a test? Do you need a vaccination? What are you going to get on those things? What it's then going on to say is that surveyed people in February begin to say that later on in 2021, they have a 72% likelihood of traveling then, right? So how do you get from 1 month saying we didn't go anywhere to, oh, I'm so thirsty to go travel that the next month when they're surveyed, it's I'm going to travel somewhere else. And I think that's it's an interesting way of showing both COVID cases declining and vax rollout that basically can show you what it's doing for optimism. Because at the end of the day, I think this is an optimism story, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 100% optimism story. I think some of that may well be down to seasonality as well. Yeah. So, you know, if you think about it, putting global pandemics aside, you know, propensity to travel in January is probably lower than propensity to travel in, let's say, May or June, just with the natural instinct of, you know, holidays and all that good stuff. I think clearly it's a confidence thing. You know, I think personally, I think I've stayed in a hotel for the first time in January, right? It felt right to do that. But I think it comes down to, as people see light at the end of the tunnel, what they'll be able to do. So one place which is obviously close to my heart is the UK. They've been in, you know, lockdown after, you know, opening up and then lockdown again. It's been a bit wonky there. And earlier this week, they announced the kind of road to recovery, if you will. And they announced that sometime at the end of June, that effectively life will be back to normal. They were the wordings of government officials that you would be able to go on international travel again, you'll be able to book summer holidays. Well, you look at then the data behind that, EasyJet announced that the bookings from the UK jumped 337% over the previous month on the day that they announced that those things was gonna happen, because people just see, great, I can go. I was also attending another presentation a few weeks back, and they actually said, which surprised me immensely, that the level of savings in the US, so people with savings in their bank account, is actually at an all-time high. Which, if you put together like unemployment, which is also at an all-time high, that doesn't really make sense. But I can understand those folks which are in work, they're storing cash to be able to spend at a later date, right?
So. Yeah, that's a great insight. Because I mean, I think we've always heard those awful quotes or all this that like the richest keep getting richer with this, right? And if you cut off the two extremes of it, right, those that new job, right? And doing that, and those that are just eternally rich, you do end up with a chunk of people that aren't really doing much except for maybe home improvements and stuff. And I mean, I don't remember the quote verbatim, but like, I think it's all time low sales for like clothing companies and those types of purveyors, where you can go and say, of course, restaurants are down. But if you go and look at like, not just department stores that were in a rough spot, but then the brands that sell them or the brands that sell direct, I mean, what type of clothes or merchandise are we buying? Not much of it. So it all makes sense to me that, you know, food and drink is down in certain areas, but that savings account piece is key of, I'm not going anywhere. You know, that money that would have been on plane tickets and stuff is not, it's still there. But I do think it's fascinating that you go from 1 month of 21% of people travel to the next month thinking, yep, 72% of those people are going to do something next in this year is, it's a good happy story.
It is, absolutely. So just to round us out for the last like news story, something that I'm personally close to, which is the HSMAA Foundation. So,
and you're a board member, right?
Correct. Yeah. So I sit on the Hospitality Sales Marketing Association for the US. So they have many different foundations across the world. So they have them in Europe and also in Asia, as well as the US. And our role within the HSMAI is to sort of give the industry perspective, but also to help them with various different tasks and things like that. So we have the larger board, and then we're broken into smaller groups. So I do one around leadership and thought leadership. So we provide points of view and help them with kind of diversity and all those different types of things. So it's really interesting to be involved, and you get to meet people that do similar or different jobs to you in various different companies, whether they be brands or whether they be the other agencies or whatever it might be. And they have the HSMAI has a foundation, which is really there to kind of elevate the overall caliber and performance of sales and marketing and revenue individuals around the world in global hospitality. And they do this by launching initiatives to attract new talent and developing emerging talent, and also kind of trying to engage people that are already in the organ, you know, already in the industry. So there's things like awards and different things like that, and they recognize the top 25 performers. But they've just announced, actually, the HSMAA Foundation, that they're opening something called a COVID relief fund, which is a plea and also a process which you can apply to have money to help you spend on various different HSMAA education opportunities. So they received a donation of $150,000 from the Carolyn Smith Foundation, and it's all linked to SDR, so Carolyn and Randy Smith. And basically what this means is hospitality companies and individuals are welcome to support the foundation, and I would encourage that, and you can make a donation and increase that fund. But importantly, you can also submit an application, and you can do this wherever you are in the world. So no matter if you're in the US or you're in Europe or in Asia. And these grants that you can apply for allow hospitality professionals to maybe gain access to different HSMAI educational programs, certificates, and membership that they may not be able to get funding for from their company or in an individual. So you can apply for a grant for a HSMAI membership, which will then give you access to different educational opportunities, or a grant to be able to do a specific course on a particular topic. And it's there to sort of help individuals. So anyone can apply for the grant. I highly encourage anybody to do it. It's a fantastic outreach program. And personally, I think it's something that HSMAI should be applauded for doing, to support the industry and in a time of need where so many people are trying to reskill themselves or change their career. And I think something like this, although $150,000 is probably a drop in the ocean, it's an amazing start. So it's really, really good work by the HSMAI.
I agree. Thank you for highlighting and finding this. And it's also amazing to see that it's the folks that started STR that are going in with this too. Of, I mean, it shows you when someone's like really into an industry, like how much they care and give and keep promoting it. And I would encourage everybody to check out the link. It's going to be in the show notes, where you can get the applications for the various regions that you live in and learn more about it. And seriously, can consider a donation, because this hits an industry where it really needs it. So it looks like a fantastic opportunity.
Yeah, so the due date for the first quarter grants is Wednesday, the 31st of March, so not too long away. And the grant recipient, so if you've applied and you're successful, you'll be notified by Thursday, April 15th. So in a very short period of time, you could have a sponsored membership to HSMAI, or you could be attending a HSMAI course or whatever it might be as part of this fund. Applications are limited to only one grant per quarter. So you can't be going and asking for four or five different grants, which I think is fair enough. And
Yes.
Yeah, and you can make those different regional applications by visiting the various localized websites. And we'll put all of those, as Mike said, into the show notes. But I think it's something when you see something like this, you recognize the world is good.
Yes, it's a good way to give back, and it's really, really cool.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. We're grateful that you can join this journey with us. The show was a little bit different this week, and we had a lot of news to cover, and we did that. So you can get in touch with the show at mds_decoded, or you can email us at mds@marriott.com. If you like today's conversation, you can spare a few minutes to share a review, especially on iTunes. That would be fantastic. And it really does help others find the show and ensure that we're sharing this knowledge and news with more and more people. The next episode will be released in 2 weeks. So make sure that you hit subscribe, and we'll go through the news and some educational content as well. And you can enjoy this podcast on any good podcasting app, and you can learn more about digital marketing at mdsdecoded.com. Thanks for listening.